Hello, human peoples. You're listening to the podcast network of Gamefully Unemployed. Support us and gain access to great exclusive podcasts like Fox Mulder is a Maniac, Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Star Trek The Next Futurama, and our latest show, Spiel Boys. Head over to patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. We do game streaming, movie nights with our patrons every Friday night, and you can even commission your own podcast about anything you want. Literally anything, within reason, and we have to do it. You are quite frankly out of excuses not to go visit patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. That's patreon.com/gamefully unemployed, which is spelled like it sounds. Do you remember when Journey had its kind of first comeback, like in 2002, yes. 2003?
I think Family Guy had that Journey joke. Right.
Yeah. Well, it was. I think Family Guy was riding that wave. So I remember. Yeah. I remember it started to come back. It was in the Don't Stop Believin' was in the trailer for Mr. Deeds, and then this, and then yeah. Journey kind of came back, and then like Family Guy did that joke like a year later.
Also, I think Guitar Hero.
Guitar Hero. That, yeah, that's true. That's true. And remember, the reason I say that is because it's a Journey song in this commercial. Sorry. Continue.
Oh yeah. Oh for sure. Well, you know what? Let's do the intro and then we'll circle back to Journey. Hi, everybody.
Hello, everyone. We'll take a journey back to Journey.
Ooh, my name is David Bell.
My name is Steve Perry, Tom Ryman.
And we just watched The Fall Guy.
Theffel Guy.
The Autumn Gentleman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. The Autumn Gent.
Tom Ryder, the biggest action star on the planet, is missing. You need to bring him back. Or Jodie's movie is dead.
Why me?
You're a stuntman. Nobody's going to notice you. That's your job. No offense.
I mean, some taking.
Which also sounds like a movie Ryan Reynolds would be in. I mean, not yes, Ryan Reynolds, Ryan Gosling. Jesus.
A completely different
Jesus.
Movie. That's like 2009 Ryan Gosling
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
No, I remember I have a friend who's like, he's an 80s punk, right? He was yep. like in his 20s in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And when everybody was like, oh,
I can see him in my head.
Yeah. Everybody got into Journey. And I remember that. And like, and then like, I think there's a Europe song. No, that the
there's
Final
a Europe
Countdown.
Song. Final Countdown okay. is Berlin. No, okay. wait, no, wait. No, you're right. It's Europe. It's Europe. I'm sorry. Berlin is, the Metro.
And then there's Boston.
There's Boston,
Chicago,
Kansas.
Anyway, when people started getting
Asia.
Back into it, yep. I remember him being like, I hate this. These bands sucked. When I was a punk in the 80s, this sucked. And we're a bunch of like younger punks like, yeah, this is great. And now I know how he feels. I've gotten to that age where people are like, oh, yeah, you know what? The Phantom Menace was actually pretty good. And it's like, no, it wasn't. It was terrible. Like it's, I'm getting that where well, it's like I, there's
yeah,
that
yeah, I,
nostalgia.
I disagree because Journey does not suck.
I think Journey rocks too.
Yeah, Journey doesn't
wrong,
suck. Like most
but
of that,
I get the sentiment.
Most
you know?
Prog rock is pretty awesome.
Yeah, but I get it.
I get the sentiment. Yeah, it is. It is yeah. very much. The Phantom Menace does not rock.
Right. And it's like, yeah, it's like
I'm not mad at anyone or anybody or anything in that movie, but it does not rock.
It does not rock. Duel of the Fates rocks.
Duel of the Fates rocks, yeah.
Is that in that one? Yes.
Yes, that's yes. That was the big yeah. piece of music from that one. And then there was the love yeah. theme in episode 2, and then it was Battle of the Heroes in episode 3, which is
right.
one of the best pieces of music, in my opinion, ever written for a movie. Because
John Williams
is awesome.
I feel like that's the last time John Williams was like, I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to go fucking balls out. And then after that, it's just like, we want the Jurassic Park theme again.
Yeah.
We want the Indiana Jones theme again.
I really like his Fableman score.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's a very quiet score because it's based around the idea that Spielberg's mom was a concert musician.
Right. Wow. Good for John Williams. Anyway, Tom, how'd you like The Fall Guy?
Dave, 4 minutes in, talking about everything else under the sun with The Fall Guy. Dave, I fucking loved The Fall Guy. It's
I
a great
the
movie.
Fall Guy.
It's a great
so,
movie.
This is a fantastic movie.
It's the John
charming.
Wick guys being like, what if we just made this funny?
Yeah. So I want to give some larger context because this
For
movie
sure.
is not doing well.
Is it not?
No, it's bombing. It's made
what?
like 20 million so far. But I, here's the thing, is I know why. We almost didn't cover it. We were going to cover I Saw the TV Glow, but it's not playing in your area. And for people wondering, we will cover it. But we decided The Fall Guy. I wasn't even really thinking of watching this movie. Because if you remember the trailers, like, you look at the poster, it's got that yellow-blue tint that, like, that, you know, the yellow-blue aesthetic that posters in, like, the 2010s had. It had the 80s music trailer. It had the, like, smirky, like, this isn't your grandfather's action film. And I would argue the marketing for this made it look like kind of every other middle-of-the-road action comedy, like Netflix style we got. And I was like, people were tweeting about this, and I saw people saying, like, I didn't even know this movie was coming out. I think on paper, I think if you just casually saw this movie advertised, you probably didn't think much of it. For me personally, it was when I looked up who wrote it. Like, the director, he's done, he did, what did he do? He did David a John Leitch. Wick.
He did, he's one half of the John Wick team. He did Deadpool 2. He's done a bunch of action films.
Yeah, good
In the John Wicks, yeah.
And then the writer, Drew Pierce, is the director and writer of Hotel Artemis, which I was like, fuck, that movie was good. That was a good movie. He also wrote Iron Man 3. And I was like, shit, that was like my favorite
Iron Man
superhero
3
movie.
Fucks.
Yep. He That's also a good wrote one. Hobbs and Shaw, which I was like, that movie stood out for dialogue. Like, they're weird insults to each other and stuff.
I like Hobbs and Shaw.
Me too. And so realizing
the
that
Rock
it was
gets
like,
in the way a little bit, but I like Hobbs
a little
and
bit.
Shaw.
But I remember like reading that and going, I think The Fall Guy, I bet it's going to be really good. And it was.
It is. It's a delight. It's like
an absolute delight.
It reminds me of a Jackie Chan movie.
Yes. It reminds me.
It's not exactly the same, obviously, because, you know, that's a whole, Jackie's his own whole thing. It's an Americanized version of it. So it's not all the clowns, the stage fighting. It's a lot of like car crashes and boat jumps and stuff like that, which still in anyway, they're not exactly the same, but it really has that vibe, that Jackie Chan vibe of like Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah, it reminds me of old action. It reminds me of True Lies a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
And this isn't to say that it's anything like those films. It's more just that it has the tone and feel of like, this is what an action blockbuster should and kind of used to be. It's, I like, right away, Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, their charisma is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a rom-com primarily. Well, not even a rom-com, but like,
almost more so. I'd say it's more
of a rom-com than it is an action movie.
Yeah, I think it definitely
in terms
like
of like the plot beats.
Yeah, it throws away obvious action beats.
Mm-hmm. It really does
to give us like romance stuff. And that was I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I like that they paid as much attention to like they. It wasn't just that this movie was a film that was created by very skilled people, like written by a great writer, a director who was a former stuntman. It's a big love letter to stunts and the stunt industry and a lot of the below the line people that work on films and don't get a lot of the credit. So we knew all of it. You would go in expecting all of that to be like perfect, but it's cool that they also spent like an equal amount of time and care on the relationship between the two main characters. There's like as much time devoted to that as there is to the Ryan Gosling being charming and getting the shit beat out of him. And these stunt spectaculars, basically the Waterworld stunt spectacular every 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, it's great. It actually was touching, I thought, how it tributed stunts. Because, this is a stunt movie. This is a lot of practical stunts. Obviously, there's CGI in there.
Yeah, they sweeten them all. But they don't.
What I really liked about this movie is it's. So I think everybody looked at this movie, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but it's not many people are seeing it. I think they saw a like written by committee, like just fucking mediocre studio action film. And what's ironic is that the movie is actually kind of mocking that
very much. So
Yeah, it has this underlying of, like, you can tell the people who wrote this and made it have been frustrated with the studio in the yep. past. One of the third act, like, like, things at stake is that the studio wants to CGI the final stunt. They're just like, we'll do it in post. We'll do the final stunt in post. And they don't want to do that. And they very much recognize, like, they're satirizing, like, Zack Snyder, Marvel, and Dune. I loved the Dune score.
When the music comes in, oh my gosh. Yeah. I also, did you notice the very pointed dig about the gun loaded with blanks?
Yes.
He goes to the actor's house and picks up, he's got all these old props in a display case, and he picks up a gun from one of the actor's movies, and he pulls the clip out, and it says blanks only on it, and he checks the one, and he pulls the slide and checks the one in the chamber, and you can clearly see that it's a blank, and yes, then he moves on, and that's just them telling us, look, if you do your job, you should be able to tell.
Yeah, it's
that's
safety.
It's like real subtle, but it's there.
It's really subtle, yes. But it's, yeah, that fucking matters. Yeah, they kind of, because it's such a stunt, because it's about stuntmen, it really does, like, show, like, they're safe. Like, they mm-hmm. stress the safety yeah. side of it yeah. a lot. And then they also aren't, like, I want to say they're not shitting on, like, superhero films.
No, not at all.
They're, like, the premise is that the movie she's making is well
great.
Loved.
Yeah. It's going to be good.
It's just, and it's pointing out stuff where you show, like, that when they're filming the stunts and then you see it post, they've added CGI. So they're not even saying, like, CGI is bad.
No.
They're just saying, like, the stunts should be
practical. They're just kind of showing you how, even when, I think it was more to show you that even when you're seeing a movie that is so draped in digital effects, most of the time, there are still humans doing the practical component
right.
of it.
As there should be.
Even if it's just as simple as that first, not as simple, but that first stunt, which is just the actual scene itself is in a very small area because the rest of this is supposed to be this huge battlefield landscape. So it's going to all be digital. It's just this very small space, but it's Ryan Gosling getting set on fire and thrown into a wall over and over again. So, like, you see that in the middle of this huge digital orgy of special effects, you might assume that I really feel like that's, like, a big part of them doing that, not to shit on the movies, but to make sure that people know that there's still humans behind the wheel.
Yeah, and that we should fight for that.
Yeah.
There's a part where they practically look at the camera and someone goes, do they give out an Oscar for stunts? And Ryan Gosling goes, nope. No, they don't. And you're like, man.
And he lets it linger for a while and then says, they do not.
It's everything from all the way down to the title, because this is, all right, this is technically an adaptation,
right? It's a TV show.
Yes, but I do not think the TV show was just, from what I read, a stuntman who's also
he's a bounty hunter. Yeah, he's like a mercenary. He uses his stuntman superpowers to, it's like the Equalizer a little bit.
Yes, and I assume it's called The Fall Guy because he's a stuntman, but
he's also The Fall Guy.
Yes, and they take that to the next level in this, I thought, because he's a stuntman, so he's doing a fall. He gets hurt. The inciting incident is a fall. He is the fall guy, literally, for framing. They frame him for a murder is the plot. Mm-hmm. So he's the fall guy for the spoilers. Spoilers, obviously. The lead actor is framing him for his murder.
For a murder,
And then at the same time, stuntmen are, in fact, the fall guys for the actors. They're taking the hits, and the actors get all of the credit and all of the stardom. So it, like, works on all these levels, that mm-hmm. just that title. And they manage to point all of that out, which is, like, stuntmen are these faceless people who do the things in movies that we then look at most action stars and go, and, like, we put our admiration
on the star,
these actors, for mm-hmm. these stunts. Obviously, we mentioned Jackie Chan. That's not the case for every action star.
No,
but
no. Clearly not.
But that all comes out in this movie that it manages to do in a little over 2 hours. It's like 2 hours and change.
Yeah, like 205, 210, maybe. It's a little bit long. It didn't feel too long to me, but
it didn't. There was
is a little bit over 2 hours, though.
It was one of those delightful things.
Where it just kept, times, where, yeah, where it was like, oh, there's more movie?
Yeah, a lot of times that's a bad thing. In this one, like the boat chase, I had to pee, and the boat chase was happening, and I was like, eh, it'll wrap up soon. And then when I realized it wouldn't, I was like, okay, I'm going to run and piss.
Yeah.
Because there's more movie here.
Substantially more movie from that point.
Yes. So the plot, I mean, people should
it's pretty straightforward. The actor disappears from the movie, and they get him on the movie to go try to quietly go find him. And he gets wrapped up in this conspiracy that eventually finds out that the lead actor, Tom Ryder, who's played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, was being a dickhead and killed his stuntman by accident. Like, he kicked him and he fell over and his head hit a glass table. Right. So they're covering it up and they're going to pin it on Ryan Gosling because Aaron Taylor Johnson, Tom Ryder, is too big to fail.
It's a nice little mystery.
Because it is,
yeah. They do little things. So, like, Ryan Gosling's character, it starts with, I believe, Ryan Gosling doing a legit stunt. That's this wonder of him on set getting ready to do this jump a second time. And we see his relationship with Emily Blunt, who's a camera operator at the time, and they're clearly like an item.
It's very cute. It's fling. Very, very cute.
Yes, and this wonder kind of establishes a bunch of stuff, which is like his total confidence. He's on top of the world. We see that the actor he's doubling for is an asshole. We get a little voiceover, which honestly wasn't that necessary, but wasn't that distracting either. And then Ryan Gosling gets all the way up on this elevator and gets put in these harnesses and jumps off. And I'm almost certain that's the stunt that Ryan Gosling... Because I heard that Gosling had done a stunt in this, and that looks like the one. Because that's also the safest stunt, because he's like all wired up and stuff.
He basically just gets dropped, 30 feet, 50 feet in a harness, and they suspend him. They stop. It looks like he is falling all the way down to the floor, but they stop him like 20 or 30 feet from the bottom.
Yeah.
You see it in the end credits. They do the Jackie Chan thing in the end credits, where they show you like behind the scenes of all the stunts.
And it's so good.
It's great.
And again, they don't shy away. Like, there's stunts where it's like, it's on a green screen.
Yeah.
But it's still a stunt.
But like, there's still a stunt component. Yeah. And they break it down for you. I just wanted to call it. It's the Alan Rickman stunt from Die Hard is what Gosling does.
Yeah. So, it's a very, I think it's a common stunt.
It's pretty safe. You're in a harness. I mean, obviously it's not, nothing's perfectly safe, but.
But the implication, so they cut away and you hear screaming. And so you learn that he has an accident. It's later revealed that the actor sabotaged it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I love, because they're even saying, like, stuntmen are safe. We're safe. The only reason this goes wrong, ultimately, is someone sabotages it on purpose. Which I liked, because, again, they're trying to specifically show how stuntmen are very professional and safe, so they have an outside influence. Ultimately, it's not the fault of the stunt team of Winston Duke. He's not there yet.
He's not there yet, but he plays the stunt coordinator. Like, there's a scene...
He's a delight.
Yeah, everybody's great. There's a scene also for the production asking for things and they don't understand what they're asking for. Like, there's a scene, the first stunt he does when he comes back to the movie, they're like, get him closer to the camera. He's like, I can't get any closer, I will hit the camera. And that's what happens.
Yeah. Oh, but what I was getting to is, so when he returns, they're like, so he's been out of work for a while.
18 months, I think, is that.
Yeah, the producer asks him back. At first, she says, like, oh, Emily Blunt wants you there. That's why we're asking you back. And the first thing they do is scan his face. And they tell him, like, yeah, it's this is how we do it now. We're scanning your skin. They scan his whole body. And they go, like, we're getting rid of your face. And we're going to use your body and put the actor on top, which I'm sure is a thing they do now, obviously.
Yeah.
The reveal later, which I thought was delightful, because you don't think anything of it.
Yep. It's so ordinary.
Yet the reveal later is, no, they weren't scanning his body. They were scanning his face to put on that video of the actor accidentally killing his stunt double.
That was the only thing they needed from him. And they get it right away.
Yep.
Like, the rest of it is a farce.
Yeah, it's like, a nice little mystery for that reason. Where
it's
you're,
very,
like,
it's very noirish.
It like, is. It's a little. It's it reminded me very much of a noir, and it's and so they, the producer is in on it. Basically, it's the producer, the actor, and she's like his producer. You
she's
know,
Tom,
like
she's Tom Ryder's producer. Basically, it's Hannah Waddingham, who is great. Of course, everybody's great in this.
Oh yeah, who is she? What?
Ted Lasso. She's from Ted Lasso.
Oh, see, I don't know them Ted Lassos.
Well, she's the shame lady from Game of Thrones.
Oh, good for her.
Yep.
Great name, Waddingham. She's British, one assumes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of British. Sure. I think Gosling's the only person. No, it's Gosling and Winston Duke. Everybody else in the principal cast is British.
Winston Duke could have gone either way for me.
Like, yeah, he could have started doing a voice and I wouldn't have questioned it.
Yeah.
Man, like, everybody on British, this production is British or Australian because they're filming it in Australia.
Yes. Which is, I like that because everything's filmed in Australia. I think this movie is sneakily, I mean, I know it costs like $120 million,
yeah,
which is still low for a lot of movies.
For
and
a movie
I would argue,
like this, that, yeah, I mean, that seems like, I mean, it still is a lot, but it doesn't seem like too much for what this movie was.
I think a sneaky amount of this movie takes place at a quarry, the same quarry. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they like the mid part. They go out and they do stuff, so it doesn't feel small. But like the beginning sequences, it's on a beach, I guess. But it all feels like roughly the same area.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the fact that a lot of it is like it's a meta thing, right? So a lot of their set is supposed to look like a movie set, and I imagine that's pretty cheap, right?
You
just use the trailers that you have and you use the equipment that you have for the most part. Obviously, I think there's some prop cameras and shit like that, but like it seems like an easy enough shoot.
Now that you pointed it out, yeah. they spend most of the time filming in the same canyon when they're actually shooting the movie.
Yeah, it's a sneaky little thing. I think this movie is really smartly written in general. Like, it's written for budget, for the reason we said, but they recognize they have to have some stuff in the middle, so they go out, they go into Sydney, which, of course, is a place that a lot of movies are filmed, so it kind of works doubly. Like, they do a part where they give him a car, and they go, be careful with it, it's a product placement. And I'm almost certain the car is an actual product placement for the movie.
Yeah,
we're
why wouldn't
watching.
It be?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, might
it's
as
sort
well.
Of how Wayne's World got away with that, where it's like, yeah, it's a meta joke, but it's like, yeah, that's a perfectly good way to sneak in some product placement into your movie.
Yeah, we want to get this movie made.
Yeah, and then it becomes like it. I couldn't help but think of Shane Black, L.A. Noir. Once we get to like the body, he finds a body in a...
I mean, he wrote Iron Man 3 for Shane Black, so it's, you know, it's checks out.
Hotel Artemis felt
Hotel
a
Artemis
little like
is.
That.
I haven't seen it, but I remember that we covered the
you
trailer.
Saw it.
I did.
We covered the movie.
We
covered
did.
The movie. Chris, isn't that Hemsworth as the
oh
cult
no,
guy?
That's Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh shit, you're right. I'm thinking of a totally different movie. Okay, Hotel Artemis is also fun though. Man, I gotta rewatch that movie now. Who made that movie?
I think Drew Goddard. It's another Drew, I think.
He's fucking Drews.
Too many.
But it's I think they do such a good job with the budget, but also I think the efficiency of plot. Like the scene you mentioned him being lit on fire and slamming into a rock. That was one of the most delightful fucking scenes, because the scene that leads up to it is Emily Blunt. He shows up on set and realizes Emily Blunt did not know he was coming, did not want
never him. Asked for him. Yeah.
Yeah. The idea is that after he got injured, he ghosted her.
Yep.
And it's like, yeah, like you said, it's been like over a year. And so we need to get out this exposition between them. And I thought they did a very good job at the idea that she doesn't hate him. She's not like they, I thought they avoided a lot of the romantic comedy pitfalls.
Yeah, like,
she's more playful with it at first,
right? And the thing he's done is it's not insurmountable. Like exactly. it's not a thing that you don't understand. Like, he basically disappeared into self-loathing because he felt like a failure, and it's totally understandable. He's a stuntman, yes, and it's livelihood, and he got hurt.
And she kind of, you can tell she kind of understands that, but she's still mad.
Yeah, because he fucking ghosted. It still sucks.
Yeah.
But, like, they made sure it was, they decided to make it a thing that hurts and was shitty, but not a thing that they couldn't get over.
Right. And so they have this scene where he has to be lit on fire and driven into a, like, flung into a rock. And she just keeps making him do it over and over again, mm-hmm, because she's mad at him. And then is like, let me give you some motivation. Let me just explain the characters to you.
Yeah.
And she explains this alien princess and this cowboy, space cowboy. And she basically just lays out all of her feelings and what their relationship was. Because we haven't actually heard it out loud.
No, yeah.
But it's cradled in this scene where the audience I was in was losing it, because basically she's taking this, the entire crew is acting like a film crew, meaning that they're hustling, they're trying, they're just like, what's the next thing? They're, mm-hmm, on edge. And she's just wasting everybody's time to get back at him and have, and like hash it out with him first thing.
Yeah. They are hashing out their what happened in their relationship in the form of scene notes, basically.
Yeah, in front of everybody.
In front of everyone.
And then, like, she's like,
asking for his input on his character. It's, yeah, basically how she's like, and what do you have to say?
While she's punishing him, while, yeah, she's while flinging she's him into a rock
him against
over and
the
over
wall
again.
On fire.
And then she's like, oh, let's get him a megaphone so he can talk. And like the PA is like, okay, flying in with the megaphone. Everybody's hustling. I just loved that energy.
It was,
and everybody's like, okay, all right. Like, because that's how they're trained to do it.
Yeah,
on set.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you got to go to the next setup. They establish this right away. This is the one of the first sequences, kind of. You know, we had the opening where he gets injured, and then we have the car stunt right before this that precipitates the fight that then leads into this scene. But this scene really is the one that kind of sets the tone of the movie. It combines, yeah, both of the things. Like, it combines the action stunt aspect of it, really the stunts more than action,
yeah,
the stunt aspect of it with the rom-com aspect of it, and they're both given equal weight in the scene. They're both equally, you know, equal weight in terms of the book, of the same amount of jokes, the same, you know, it's just, yeah, really well executed and a really great way to let us know what the movie is going to be right up front.
Yeah. And the scene before it also does that a little bit.
Yeah.
Or like it's, a few scenes where they show
continuous.
Emily Blunt,
yeah,
on set, and everybody's bringing their problems to her, and there's all this shit happening around her. And it shows, like, you can tell that the director really wanted to show how it feels to be a director, where she's like having to solve all these problems simultaneously. For a movie about, a lot of movies about making movies tend to, It's very ironic that, like, whenever they show making a movie in a movie, it's often portrayed very wrongly. Like, it's often this, like, kind of cartoonish version.
Yeah.
And this felt like it's doing a little of that, but it was trying,
right, I
more
feel like
than
her,
a lot of movies.
I feel like her AD would have handled more of that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's,
I was
little
like, come
things,
on, buddy,
but,
what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
She needs to stay focused.
They did do a good job, because like every AD I've ever seen has been like 2 seconds away from a heart attack.
Yes.
At every given moment.
Yes.
And I like that.
I have met this guy.
Yeah. I was an AD once. I was an AD once. And it is like that. And the unit production manager are basically, their job is to be like just everybody's babysitter, is like actually the person that most of the problems go through, right? So
yeah, it's like thinking back to even just doing like the zombie show on Cracked, and that's directed, yeah, by Abe, who's, it's Abe, you know, it's my buddy,
right?
I didn't get to speak to Abe that day.
Yeah, exactly.
I spoke to the AD a lot,
right? And then usually the second AD, I think Cracked didn't have a second AD usually.
I don't
happens,
think on that shoot they did. I don't remember.
If I remember correctly, it's been a while, but a second AD is actually supposed to be the person who handles actors, specifically like extras, background, featured extras, where the first AD is supposed to be the crew person. I mean, correct. I mean,
I mean, you went to film school. I don't know anything.
There's it's certain, like, the unit production manager tends to be the person who literally manages the production, like if the production was a Taco Bell, they'd be the manager. You know, they're handling payroll, they're handling scheduling, shit like that. And then, like, first AD, I think, is like the go-to between the director and the crew, like the grips and the camera and stuff. And second AD is the actors, handling the actors stuff, I think. But it's been a while. So they kind of boil it all down.
Digression we went on there.
Yeah. But it's fun in this movie. But the point being that those few scenes are so efficient, and, like, we know everything about their characters, about who they are, based on all these little details, little things where it's like Ryan Gosling, when he gets on the plane, I like that he, like, puts on a little sign that says "Wake for meals" and falls asleep, where it's like, yeah, that is the vibe. He's giving the vibe of "Wake me for food."
Yeah.
And that's where he starts as. He has given up completely.
Yeah.
And then kind of showing, yeah, there's also, again, little sneaky things like the efficiency of the sets. I want to mention also the actors, like, little apartment, his house.
Oh, the one that's covered in the post-it notes.
Yes. Which is a fun bit.
I like that that's a plant and payoff. Like, we hear about it before we see it.
Yes.
Like, she just mentions it. She's like, yeah, he left a note. It's like, oh, it's one of his, he's still doing the post-it notes thing, huh? And she's like, yeah, his house is, like, full memento now. Yeah. And then 45 minutes later, or not, probably not that long, but it's a little while later, we finally get to his house, and we just see that it is wallpapered in post-it notes, except for his mirror. There's a perfect outline of his silhouette in the mirror, so he can still see himself.
Because we've barely seen this character, who is the villain.
Yeah.
And we kind of know everything about him as well. Like,
yeah,
because the post-it notes are all these really dumb questions.
Like, fire masseuse. Yeah. Is it Momoa or Mamoa?
Yeah. What is it? Like, why is Kung Pao chicken orange or something?
It was a reference to the Bare Naked Ladies song.
Oh, Chinese chicken orange?
Yeah, something like that.
That's so funny. And then he has all these props, and they set up the props really nicely, because that's when you see the blank gun, where you see the axe, and then he leaves that place, and I thought, like, oh, we are coming back there, aren't we? Because they do all this scene work in that scene.
To establish the geography of it.
Yeah.
Like, and, I feel like we're going to use this place.
It's really
making
well done.
Sure we know the layout of this apartment.
And they're it's this efficiency of that and the comedy, I thought.
Yeah.
There's a part later where, so he goes on this kind of noir hunt where he's asking around trying to find this actor.
Tom Ryder,
He gets drugged by, and they do a good job at not saying it's acid. They just pretend it's a magical drug.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist. And he says to the guy who drugged him, because he gets the better of him, and they do this fight where he's on drugs while fighting, so everything's sparkly.
It's very Deadpool. To the point where he even sees a unicorn, and that's one of my favorite bits in the movie. Where
I love a good horse.
They just,
you know me.
The drug jailer just tells him, he finally, it's an awesome action sequence, but it looks like when Deadpool got stabbed in the head almost. Like, it's very, like, kind of animated and weird, but he's still beating ass.
Yeah.
And he finally catches up to the drug dealer. He's like, when is this going to wear off? And he's like, as soon as you stop seeing unicorns. So for the next 30 minutes, basically, each new scene, you'll see a unicorn somewhere behind him.
Yeah, it's just somewhere like, where's Waldo?
So you know he's still high.
It's such a good...
It's such a great little device, yeah.
Yeah, it's efficient storytelling. Yep. It's funny.
And it's a joke. Yeah, it's a great joke.
And it's a good... I thought it was a good joke because they also... It's just a horse.
Yeah.
And horses are funny. Like, it's just a horse sitting with a horn on its head.
Yeah.
What am I doing here?
Glued something to its head.
Yeah. My owner told me to come here and stand here, and no one's telling me why, but I'll stand here. And the horse doesn't look happy to be there. It's just a fucking horse. And that's, like, they do a little bit where he sneaks into the apartment, and then they have he has a call with Emily Blunt, and she keeps calling him to ask him about, to kind of consult with him about her movie.
We see kind of the heart of their relationship is that they're collaborators.
Yes.
Like they make each other better. And they get excited about talking about creating stuff and being creative, and he's able to let her do. Yeah, it's a really cool way that they do their relationship in the movie. I really liked it.
Yeah, the breaking point basically is when she realizes what's happening, because he has to, like, the idea is that, like, her career is at stake. He keeps getting told that.
It's her first
movie.
She's
going to be in director's jail if this doesn't work out, if they don't find this guy.
Yeah, and they don't flat out say it, but the implication is clearly there. She's a woman as well, and it's her first movie. And
comic book movie.
Yeah, women directors very often don't get second chances coming out of movie jail. Yeah. It's...
So he wants her to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So they do a good job at him, like, he needs to sort of hide this from her because he doesn't want her to get involved. She's stressed out enough.
Right. Yeah.
It's a good motivation for keeping it from her.
Yeah. He can't tell her that her lead actor is missing.
Right. And they don't, I was scared they were going to lean on that too. You know, so many romantic comedies have that moment where you're tell her.
The farce aspect where it's just, it's, you're keeping the ball in the air because you're just not sitting down and having a conversation to get on the same page.
But they don't, there's a moment where she thinks he has left because the producer says, like, I gave him, but then they
it doesn't even last very long. Yeah.
Yeah. They take it back immediately.
And it's like he's only ever supportive of her. She's only ever supportive of them. Like, we see, it's not just that they're collaborators, but we see that their collaboration is a truly, like, special, beautiful thing. Like, they're just supportive of each other. It's not toxic or negative in any way.
Yeah.
Really cool. I don't know.
The breaking point is when she figures out, where she's like, oh God, you've been framed. We got to get you out of here.
She's talking about, we got to burn your fingerprints off.
Yeah. And he's like,
south of the border.
And he keeps talking about having to save the movie. And she's like, what? And he's like, we got to save your movie. It's everything. It's your whole thing. Like, and she realizes that this whole time he still just cares about her movie, specifically because he cares about her. And that's like the moment, you know, the big romantic kiss moment and stuff like that. But before that, in the apartment, they do that split screen scene, which is very meta, where she's calling him to ask him what he thinks about
whether
split
she
screens.
Should do it. And they explain the function of it. It's like to show the divide between two characters and how they're in two different. They're basically explaining the film theory behind a split screen shot.
Yeah, it was very fun because it felt like they were being meta. And I think they realized they were being, like, very film school meta. So they wanted to, like, just say these things sometimes.
It was in a fun, engaging way, though, for that. Like, it was.
The audience loved that scene that was in because she also had an alien monster hand the whole time.
Yeah.
She was just casually wearing.
And they were mimicking each other. Mimicking each other's. So there was the subtlety of it where they are just doing the thing that they're talking about to show the divide. But what it's actually showing us is that they're more on the same page because they do the same gestures at the same time, at the same moments.
Yeah.
I had another thought about it, but I lost it. Oh, that's what it is. I like that this movie, unlike a lot of movies that I've seen about movie making, which don't set out to, I don't think they set out to be condescending, but I think that can be how it comes across because sometimes it just feels like a few movies I've seen about the making of movies really rest on the idea that it's this, like, exclusive club and it's very storied and traditioned and it's kind of impenetrable a little bit. There's always, like, this impenetrable aspect of it to me anyway. I like that this movie doesn't come from that. It shows, like, it's, like, really focused on, like, the positive teamwork aspect of just a crew of people coming together to make something. And the only kind of shitting it does of the industry, I think, at least directly with Venom, is sort of, like, dressing down the Aaron Taylor Johnson type. Not him, but the character he's playing in this movie, where he gets all the credit and he gets to they have this line in their flat. Oh, actually, no, I'm sorry. They don't have this line in there. But the idea that because he's this great genius that makes these great hits, he gets to treat people however he wants to.
Yeah, here's what I'll say. Certain news has come out recently around a certain action star.
Yeah.
Who was perhaps in Hobbs and Shaw, a movie that these people were associated with.
These people were responsible for.
And that's what it is. This isn't a cynical movie. It doesn't shit on the audience. It doesn't shit on Marvel. It doesn't shit on big, dumb movies. It's a celebration, which is why it's such a shame. Like, I'm like, motherfuckers, everybody go see it.
I think, I'm sorry, real quick. I think I just figured out what I was trying to say, is that this is more focused on movies as a craft, as like a skill, a trainable craft, a thing that people come together to make. And what a lot of other, like a movie like, just La La Land or something like that, tend to really focus on the ineffable aspect of creativity, like the really glorifying the artiste part of it. Oh, the ideas come from. It's like, well, there's a lot more than just the ideas. We don't, all of the worship and praise, you know, shouldn't be heaped on the people who have the ideas, you know.
Did you see Living in Oblivion?
No, but I've told you about it. Need to see it. Yeah.
Yeah. I've mentioned before, but people haven't seen it. It's a 90s film with Steve Buscemi. I mean, Carrie Ann Moss is in it. There's a bunch of people.
Peter Dinklage, right?
Peter Dinklage is there. And it's an entire movie about an indie film. And they're just trying to get one shot done. The entire movie is about an indie crew trying to get one shot done. And it's a really like good love letter to indie craft. To me, this felt like a love letter to the complete opposite side, to the giant bloated Hollywood film. Because that's the idea, is they're showing like, listen, we're making a fun movie. Is it art? I don't know. Maybe not. You know, like this big, they keep talking about Comic-Con and like, they're not shitting on the movie itself, but they're taking the piss out of it a little bit. They're doing like, the Dune music.
Yeah, we can see that it's a little silly, but like, so's Dune. So are all the, so superhero movies. Like it's,
exactly.
It's never pooping on them. And
it's make-believe. It's all make-believe.
Right. And I love that they resisted the very, very easy comedy idea of making the movie that they're making obviously terrible.
Yes.
Like they making it a bad movie. That's such an easy joke bucket, but they decided to, no, it's good. This is going to be a good movie. Everybody's going to like this.
Yeah. They do. They make the movie look cheesy.
They
don't
do.
Get me wrong.
But yeah.
But in the context of the world, everybody's excited for it.
It doesn't. It doesn't look, from what we can see out of context, it doesn't look any more cheesy than any other sci-fi action blockbuster that we've seen come out.
What they're pointing out is these movies are, all of them rely so much on stunt people, to the point that when you think about it, they sort of are pointing it out in this, is that Emily Blunt has way more of a relationship with Ryan Gosling and the stunt crew, because that's mostly who she works with. And you think about like all these movies with a lot of stunts. It's like, yeah, like, don't get me wrong, you know, Chris Evans is there a lot, but they probably spend most of their days with the stunt people, because those are the people doing most of the action. And that's most of these movies.
Most of
the
movies. Yeah. It's even in the fighting, it's usually them. But I love that this is like, it's that, you know, but the blue collar version of it.
Right. They're showing the stunt crew, and then they're showing the director, and they're showing like, listen, this might not be like an art house film, but this director, she has to do a lot. She's managing.
This is hard. Yeah. This is not easy.
Yeah. And that's what they're pointing out, is like, this is a fucking nightmare.
It took thousands of people to make Quantumania.
Yeah, exactly. And those people, every film set is a little family. Everybody
it's a, it's
has
a, it's
these
a little economy unto itself for like, you know, 10 or however many months it's in production.
Right. That's what people love making movies. It's one of the most fun things to do and one of the most stressful things. I mean, there are probably more stressful things out there, perhaps.
Nah. It making movies. The stakes don't get any higher than Dune 2.
It's very obvious and funny that the third act of this is the entire crew banding together to fight, to physically fight the terrible, greedy producer who talks about the audience like they're shit. She like says, like, they'll take whatever slop I'll give them. And the huge ego shitty actor who has hijacked the movie. And it's that versus the crew. And I'm like, man.
And they, well, it's
you are getting out some frustrations.
They
aren't
are,
you?
They are. But also, it had to end that way. Well, I mean, it doesn't have to. But like, why make the hero a stuntman if it's not going to be incorporated into his character? So, like,
right.
The big third act is basically they beat the bad guys with movie making. They beat the bad guys with stunt work, and
they could have easily a lesser movie would have forgotten to do that. Yeah. I think. And that's why I think this movie is so well written, where I was like, I can't believe you managed to juggle all these elements and like do a dumb, fun action movie while like actually saying something and talking about the dynamics of, because again, the whole thing is the producer's like, we'll do the final jump in post. And they're like, no, we won't. We'll do the final fucking jump for real. And we'll beat the villain who happens to be the producer who wants to do it in post.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the movie does a real awesome jump.
That's a sick ass huge jump. Fucking,
yeah,
there are
stunts in this
incredible stunts in this movie.
There were stunts that when I first saw them, I was like, oh, okay, I guess they CGI'd that a little. And then you watch the ending and I'm like, oh, I guess not.
Like, yeah, I mean,
part where they're in the dump truck and they're like on the road and it's spinning. Thought that was like, oh, they put them in a green screen and had them fight. And I was like, nope. They did that on the street, and I was like, shit, man.
There's techniques, you know, that's, they're not going as fast, and I think we talked about it in the Duel episode of Spiel Boys, but if you film at a low angle, there's a certain way you can film cars driving where they can be going 20 miles an hour, but it looks like they're flying down the road.
Oh yeah. You see that effect all the time when you like film the road and you zoom in.
Mm-hmm.
It goes like, it looks like you go slower more you zoom in.
They show that scene in the end credits, and they are just driving down the street in this thing with this thing spinning around as Ryan Gosling is in there for some of the shots, and then obviously it's stuntmen for the shots.
Everybody's
having a fist fight
wire
with this guy. Yeah, also everybody has a harness and wires on them. That's what a lot of the digital stuff sweetening is for, is to take the wires and the crash pads out.
Yeah, they don't shy away from, again, recognizing that.
Yeah.
Which is like, a lot of digital artists
safely, let's do it safely. But if we can drop a real guy out of a helicopter, it is going to look better than a digital effect 100% of the time.
Yeah, and so they do.
Yep, they and that is fearsome.
Yeah.
You don't realize how high it is, again, because of the way things are look when you film them through certain lenses, but when they show the stunt again at the end and they show it from like his perspective as he just goes spiraling out of the it's a sweet fall too, like he pinwheels. It just looks so much higher than it does in the movie.
It really does.
It's like, oh my god.
I want to go back to the marketing real quick.
Yeah,
because I realized something. I said this movie had bad marketing. I actually, before
I think they decided to focus on Ryan Gosling because of the Barbie wave from last year in the Oscars. Anyway, sorry, continue.
I think the trailers needed to be different, because I would argue the marketing itself. Did you guys, did anybody see like all the red carpet stuntmen shit? And like they were doing brawls on the red carpet. Look it up. There's so many red carpet things where like literally they introduce Ryan Gosling by like two guys smashing out of some glass and he walks through the glass. They had people in harnesses like doing fucking all these stunts. He appeared on Kimmel, and it actually reminded me a lot of, do you remember when Bruce Willis was marketing, of all things, 12 Monkeys, and he went on Letterman on the front of a car? It wasn't him. They did this whole bit where they introduced Bruce Willis. You can look it up. And they showed this like elaborate fight, and a car drives into the Letterman set and with a stuntman on it, and the stuntman goes flying into the set, and then Bruce Willis comes out of the rubble with a giant gash on his face and just does the interview with this fake gash
on
his face.
That's really fucking funny.
To support 12 Monkeys. It's so funny because it's like, huh, not the movie, whatever.
That was Ryan his Gosling, reputation at the time, you know, action guy.
Yeah, they did a intro for Kimmel where Ryan Gosling fought through the lobby and did this elaborate set and busts his way on. And it's like, it felt like that. It was like, oh my God, it's the 90s again. We're doing this. This is so wonderful. So, like, that's all to say that they did some really fun, creative shit for the marketing of this. But you just said, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what happened. Like,
I don't know.
It seems like none of this shit made it to people's algorithms or whatnot. I guess social media is not what it used to be right now, too.
Could be something's going on.
Yeah, but there was some legitimately cool marketing for this, and it was all around stunts. They basically were saying, we're making a stunt movie. This is all about stunts. Everything we're going to do is around stunts, and I wonder if they really needed to like put that more in the trailers or something. I don't know. I don't know what could have boosted this movie.
Well, in a just world, it wouldn't have to live and die by its opening weekend either.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, I think word of mouth.
Time for
I think,
word of mouth might help. Because that helped the Nice Guys. I mean, the Nice Guys still didn't do well, but like that got word of mouth building up steadily.
I mean, I just mentioned 12 Monkeys. That is the most profitable Terry Gilliam film ever made. And so like profit does not equal good movie is my point, you know?
Yeah.
It's just
nice when good things are rewarded.
Right. For the record, 12 Monkeys is a good movie. I'm not saying that. I should say it's his most profitable movie and it didn't make that much of a profit.
And it was considered a financial failure.
Yeah. And so that's all to say, I think, yeah, what I think this will have a lot of life on streaming. I really hope it doesn't hurt these filmmakers' chances of making something else.
I doubt it. I mean, he's still got that Deadpool juice. Yeah, this was really fun.
It's becoming a better year for blockbusters. In fact, actually, I think this is one of the, this and last year, I'm starting to feel like blockbusters are coming back. Mm-hmm. It's just that I don't know if the audience is, I think they're so jaded, you know, that it's hard, man.
We'll just give it time, I think.
Yeah. Because I think Barbie and Oppenheimer, they were juiced by the Barbieheimer, and then those movies happened to also be very good. And then I think of I had some others. It'll come back to me. But like, I don't know, we're starting to see a more variety.
Yeah.
Oh, Dune.
Dune.
We're starting to see that like serious fantasy back. I'm hoping to get more of that. And it just feels like we're getting more into like a wide variety of movies that are offering, you know, I haven't seen this variety since in the
blockbuster space specifically.
Yeah. I haven't seen this wide variety since pre-superhero, you know, mm-hmm. like we were really in it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
That boat crash was fun. That was straight up like stunt show.
Well, then he says that. He says that's how she realizes he's still alive as she watches the footage of the crash. And then right then he walks in the room. He's like, yeah, that's Miami Vice stunt spectacular. I used to do that stunt 4 times a day for like 5 years.
Yeah, he says earlier, like, I could do this stunt with my hands tied behind my back. And then sure enough.
He does.
Yeah.
Because he is handcuffed.
That was a little moment. I've been writing something that has action scenes, and like one of my favorite things to do, and I don't know if this is how other people do it, this is just how I've been doing it. You put the character in a situation where you yourself legitimately are like, damn it, how do you get out of this? And then you try to think about a smart way to get out of it. I really liked when they tied him to the chair and they're pouring gasoline on him.
That's a great moment.
Yeah. And then he lights the thing and he spits it on him. That was such a good little solution to like, okay, a person's tied in a chair, they can't get out, gasoline's pouring on them, how do you get out of that situation? Just gulp some of the gasoline.
Yeah,
smart little move. A lot of smart little moves like that.
It's part of, you know, it's all part of choreography, right? I mean, part of it's writing, part of it's choreography. It's all cut from the same cloth. It's what makes these movies their most fun for me.
Yeah.
It's when the choreography is really clicking. And then, of course, this also, it's a very sweet rom-com. It's very funny. Everybody's so goddamn charming.
the chemistry is unbelievable. Between Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, they're both very funny. They're both just bouncing off each other. They've given each other the right looks. Like, it's just like, man, you really believe these two people are into each other mm-hmm. and are right for each other. And then just the stunts, they're not the biggest stunts in the world, right? It's not superheroes. But it felt like that's part of the relief, which is like that last Fast and the Furious, man, it bummed me out.
Oof, yeah.
Watching like Vin Diesel drive down the side of the dam in
a
all
weightless
CGI
car.
Shot.
Yeah.
And it's like,
with
if
a
you're
blank
gonna,
look on his face.
Yeah. Yeah. No stakes. And it's like, if you're going to do car stunts, actually do the
maybe
car
drive a car. Yeah. We can add the dam collapsing around him later, but at least have him fucking ramp something. Come on. Yeah. It's a Fast and Furious movie.
Yeah. And it felt like for a while we were forgetting that of like, if you're going to do this scale, like stunts, motorcycles, like you do the stuff, you actually do. That's the point of this type of stunts.
It's always going to look better.
Yeah. And it's nice to see a movie do that again. You know, I get it when it's like superhero battles. It's like,
what are you gonna
blow up a spaceship practically. I guess you could do a model.
You could,
but
yeah.
Like, I get it.
They built a shocking number of models for The Phantom Menace.
It's true.
a lot of work went into The Phantom Menace.
Yeah. A lot of model work.
That is a very nice looking movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish it was lit better, but that's a different conversation, I guess.
It's lit pretty janky. It's early days of we'll do everything on the green screen. So it looks it's lit kind of like old FMV video games.
Yes.
A little bit.
There's a lot wrong.
Hadn't quite ironed that one out yet.
Yeah. Maybe everybody shouldn't deliver their lines robotically. I don't know. Just a thought. But yeah, this
is not
an
actor's director.
Yeah. This is just the best version of a modern action. Like, yeah. And I like, you have your John Wicks, right? And that's a karate kung fu. This is the other side of it, which I love.
John Wick's
this
more, is, I would separate that slightly. To me, John Wick's more about the there's a slight separation from like The Raid for John, even though they're very, very close. But John Wick seems more about like the weapons and like the gun kata and.
But it's fighting, right?
But it is both fight choreography, but kind of a different focus. But it's still it's the same. Yeah. It's the same genre basically. They're slightly different in my mind. I can't quite explain why.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Just because Rama never uses guns, really, he's always kicking people.
Right, but generally speaking, whenever we talk about action films. Action stunts, there's the two camps in my head. There's like Jackie Chan, where you're just watching two humans beings. They could be in a completely empty room and you're just watching the craft of fighting, of martial arts. And then there's like True Lies, where it's like, what can we ramp off of what? You know, what can we get stunt people in a limo and have that limo drive off of a bridge and pull the stunt people out?
So there's the one where it's the fights where it's the choreography like dance.
Yeah.
And then there's stunts where it's, we're going to throw this car into that helicopter and it's going to be awesome.
And I think the latter was in peril for a while.
I think so.
The latter is the thing that we've started to slowly replace with CGI. And I think it's not lost in the director. I think a lot of this movie is his frustrations. I think specifically for Hobbs and Shaw, like I suspect there was a stunt in Hobbs and Shaw that was supposed to be a car stunt that they said, no, we'll do it in post.
And maybe it's like, maybe that last one when they're on the train of cars and linked up to the helicopter, that would have been the one that sticks out in my mind. But
same.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, I see the reasons why, you know, obviously you have more control. It is safer to do it all digital.
From a producer perspective, it's like, oh, of course, let's do it in post. That's so much easier. We don't have to go outside, you know?
Yep.
And like you said, it's safer. It's cheaper.
There's no risk of anyone getting injured.
Yeah.
Except maybe some fucking just a farm of overworked visual effects artists getting carpal tunnel.
The mental health of a bunch of fucking
grinding these artists into dust.
Yeah. So it is, of course they want it to do it that way. But the job of a filmmaker is to say no, you know, absolutely not. The job of the director traditionally was supposed to be the foil of the producers. And like, I feel like the producers used to understand that. Like going back to Terry Gilliam, almost every behind the scenes story is like producers were like the villain of his story, but they still ultimately would like play ball because he had power. And now it feels like they're kind of showing that threat here, which is like the director isn't anything here. She has to fight. She has to fight to make this movie. Because at any point they could just go, "Nah, you're fired." You know, like
they tried to.
It doesn't matter.
Hannah Waddingham's like, "Oh, we're just changing the ending. We're not going to do the jump. We'll just do it in digital and post-production."
Yeah, she has to hijack the set basically to do the jump is the idea.
She has to abduct Tom Ryder. Yeah. Oh man. Do you have any other thoughts? I could talk about this movie forever, but we're already hitting an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I just think people should go see it. It's for like to me this movie is perfect in the way that a blockbuster should.
This is everything I want from a popcorn blockbuster.
It's actually more than what I want because as we talked about it, I realized like it meant something. And it didn't need to. It didn't need to mean as much as it meant. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't need to feel like... I almost teared up a little when I at the ending credits when I was like, they're showing the stunts. Like, this is truly, like, a tribute to stunts in such a beautiful way that it touched me. Or it shouldn't have. It didn't need to. It had no business doing that.
That shouldn't have happened.
Yeah. So yeah, see this. Also see I Saw the TV Glow because I think that's going to be a real weird horror movie. This is a good weekend. This is a good weekend for movies and no one's going out and seeing these
movies.
The movies are back.
They're lonely. They're lonely. You need to go spend some time with the movies.
Yeah. When I say go see this weekend, I fully recognize this comes out on a Monday.
You mean this weekend? Yeah. They know. They can figure it out.
Or Time Machine, if you had one. You know, use it. It's right there. Use your time machine. I got nothing else to say.
We can be finished with this episode, Dave.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
Look, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed, GAMEFULLY unemployed, for just $5 a month. That's less than a movie ticket. That's less than a lot of things. That's less from to a Twitter Blue subscription,
it's less than
which I think
$10.
Is like $20 now.
It's less than $20.
It's less than $6.
It
is. For $5 a month, you get access to four exclusive podcasts. Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Fox Mulder is a Maniac, Star Trek The Next Futurama, Spiel Boys. Those are all on our Patreon. There are so many. There's almost 1,000 at this point, I feel, like podcasts. We also watch movies every Friday night. That's a little more money, but we do that with pals, and we have lots of fun. We watch good movies. We watch bad movies. We watch movies. We like movies.
Yeah. You know? We're movie people. Sometimes we watch TV shows, like this past Friday. We also have a store. Head over to GamefullyUnemployed.com, where you can find a link to our Teespring store. We have all kinds of cool original artwork and designs you can get on T-shirts, mugs, stickers, posters, all sorts of stuff. So slap your little fallen peepers onto that.
Yeah. If you like X-Files, I think our merch store is like...
Mostly X-Files.
It's
mostly
stuff.
Mulder stuff.
Yeah. There's some Batman stuff too. So
there's some
check
Batman.
That shit out.
Yeah. Check it out. Yeah. We can be done, right?
What? Hold? Yes.
Yes.
Hey, listen, our music is produced by Chris Corlew. You can find him on twitter.com as The Corlew or go to shipwreckedsailor.bandcamp.com. Our channel artwork is produced by Michael Vincent Bramley. For more of his work, go to mvbramley.art. Our episode artwork is by Justin Brown, available on Twitter as Justin T. Brown or at artnessbyjustinbrown.com. And finally, additional artwork is by Starlene Hodge. You can find her work at starlenearts.com or on Twitter as StarleneX. Cool. Goodbye.